towards an explicit realization of discrete holography, and then we'll discuss how aperiodic spin chains can arise from hyperbolic tessellation, so from tessellation of ADS space. The outline is the following. So we'll start by introducing our setup and also giving some motivations for this program. And the idea is to take the concrete disk, which is, can be seen as a time slice of ADS3, and then put a particular discretization of it, known as regular hyperbolic tiling, and we will see what it is. Then we'll discuss some of its properties, and our goal is to define, to understand how it's possible to define a boundary theory for this possible holographic duality. And for this purpose, we review the notion of a periodic spin chain, and is a well-known idea in condensed matter theory, and we'll try to understand which is the relation between them and our setup. Then, in order, we will choose a specific aperiodic chain, and we'll study the critical properties of this chain. In particular, we focus on the entanglement entropy. And then we also discuss a tensor network construction for reproducing the ground state of this spin chain, and we'll gain more insight from this. And in the end, I'll draw some conclusions and some interesting future perspectives. So the main motivation comes from the holographic duality that, as you know very well, is when we have a quantum gravity theory in a D plus one dimensional space-time, which is dynamically dual to a quantum theory without gravity defined at the boundary of the space. And the best known example is ADS CFT correspondence, when the quantum gravity theory is defined on a negative curve space-time, while the quantum theory is a conformal field theory with gauge degrees of freedom. One well-known notion that has been used to study ADS-CFT correspondence and allow to gain a lot of insights is the notion of entanglement. And in particular, let's quickly review the definition of entanglement entropy, which is an entanglement measure, and how this is usually computed in ADS-CFT. So let's consider a pure state, for instance, of the conformal field theory that we have at the boundary. And let's consider a special bipartition into a subsystem A and its complement B. So we can consider the density matrix of our system, and we can trace over the degrees of freedom of the subsystem B. What we obtain is the reduced density matrix rho of A. And then the entanglement entropy, which is a measure of the bipartite entanglement between A and its complement, is given by the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix. Now, how to compute this quantity in the context of conformal field theory or quantum field theory or many-body systems is well known. There are a lot of techniques and been intensively studied in many branches of theoretical physics, and not only. And in ADS-CFT correspondence, Ryu and Takayanagi proposed in 2006 this formula known as Ryu-Takayanagi formula. And they say that the entanglement entropy is proportional to the area of the minimal area codimensional wall surfaces, the bulk, which is anchored to the boundary of the subsystem A that we are considering. And in the case, for instance, of ADS3, we can consider fixed time slice as in this sketch here. And if we consider A to be an interval, so the Ryu-Takayanagi surface is a geodesic whose endpoint corresponds with the entangling point of the region. So these are notions that we are going to use throughout this talk. And now we are ready to ask the question that basically is driving our program. Is it possible to establish a duality between a discrete theory defined on a given version of a discretized anti-de Sitter space and a theory defined on the boundary of the discrete geometry? So in literature, we already have some examples of approaches trying to address this question. For instance, we have the periodic ADS-CFT by the group of Gubser and Heidemann and Marcolli and collaborators, and or the modular discretization of ADS2 by Floratos and collaborators. Now, our approach, the approach that I'm going to present, is different from this approach in the sense that we consider a different discretization of the ADS space, and therefore we expect to obtain also different results, or in general, to gain different insights. OK, so let's start by constructing the setup we want to consider in the bulk, so this is a discrete bulk. So we start by considering ADS3, and we fix a constant time slice. Here is represented by this blue disk, and this is the Poincaré disk. This is the metric that we have on the fixed time slice, where we denote by R the ADS radius. And this metric induces a geodesic distance on the plane. And so now we have a continuous setup. Now we impose on this continuous setup a discretization. And we do it by considering so-called regular hyperbolic tilings. These are discrete tessellations of the Poincaré disk that are characterized by two integer numbers, p and q, that are called Schlaeffle parameters, this pair here. And this tessellation is made in a very precise way, in such a way that the Poincaré disk is tiled with identical regular pigons, in such a way that at each vertex of the lattice, we have exactly q regular pigons that are meeting. So here we have some examples for different Schlaeffle parameters pair. And in principle, one can have various, actually, pairs. But the fact that you are trying to tessellate an hyperbolic space with negative curvature imposes a constraint on the values of P and Q that are allowed. And the constraint is given by this inequality. So even if the values on P and Q are constrained, we still have infinitely many possibilities. And therefore, one goal, for instance, understand which is the difference in our setups by varying this pair of parameters. And also, let me also introduce some convention. So for instance, let's consider this 5,4 tiling, though the fundamental object is a pentagon. And notice that here, all the pentagons are equal among each other. We just see them differently because we are projecting the hyperbolic space on a plane. And so we can simply study one pentagon or one generic tile, and we denote by S the length of the edge, by R the circumradius, and by rho the distance between the center of the polygon and the edge itself. So these three quantities, or as the other geometric quantities from this polygon, can be determined in terms of the P and Q parameter and the ADS radius by using hyperbolic trigonometry and the distance D that we have defined before. So we don't give here the explicit expression, we just want to make clear when we talk about these three quantities, what are we talking about, because later they will be useful in our analysis. And now, before going on, let me give some motivation for studying the regular hyperbolic tilings as a discretization of ADS spacetime. So, first of all, as theoretical physicists, we know that it's very important to know the symmetries of our system, because that can be a very useful guideline for constructing the setup or benchmark for the results. And the symmetries of this, the hyperbolic tiling that I just introduced, are known. And in particular, so what we do basically is to break the PSL2R symmetry of the Poincaré disk down to a discrete group. Every time we do this, we call the resulting group a Fuchsian group. So a Fuchsian group is a class of discrete groups. And here we have, given the very specific tessellation we are choosing, we have a very specific class of Fuchsian group. So if we tile the infinite tiling, so we tessellate the infinite non-compact Poincaré disk, we obtain as a symmetry group the triangle group defined here by delta PQ2, that here is a presentation in terms of these generators A and B. And this group is a discrete, infinite, and non-abelian. If, on the other hand, we choose a finite tiling, as we will do later, and for instance, we can choose to put a tile in the middle of the Poincaré disk and then constructing the tile around this central, the tiling around the central tile symmetrically in order to preserve the symmetry of the tile itself, then what we call this the resulting tiling a finite tiling. And the symmetry is given by the dihedral group, dp, where p is one of the Schlaeffle parameters that defines the tessellation. And now this is the definition of the group that is, again, discrete and non-abelian, but differently from delta is finite. And so this makes, from the point of view of group theory, the thing's more simpler. Sorry? Yeah, so let's say difficulty, because for doing these pictures, we have chosen a finite amount of tiles, of course. So usually this is what we do, because we want also to, for instance, we think to construct physically these tilings, and of course, in order to do so, we need a finite amount, even if very large, of tiles. But yeah, here we see, in general, what is called regular hyperbolic tiles in the infinite tessellation. So this is the usual definition, but for our setup will be important, we will see later, to consider a finite subtiling of this infinite tiling. Exactly. In specifically, if you consider, so this setup is exactly the one I was telling you before, with a tile in the middle. So what we basically do is we construct concentrically the tile, and we stop at a sort of finite cutoff.
And then Renee is asking, why is the number of layers
manager
to the
image
the DAP representation there on the website?
Yeah. Here?
Yeah. So he was asking why the number of layers for the finite cutoff is
the interior. Because as long as we keep the number of layers finite, and we preserve the symmetry of the central tile, the symmetry does not change. Okay, so this is, let's say, more a theoretical reason, like in order to have more control on our setup. And recently, there have been also attempts to experimentally realize a discrete version of these hyperbolic spaces, and in order to access physics on these specific discrete hyperbolic geometries. So let me mention these two approaches, the one by Collard and collaborators, and they consider circuit electrodynamics on these tilings. So in this paper, they basically simulate the experiments. So at the moment, even if there have been attempts to construct them experimentally, this is just at level of simulation. But it's very interesting, however, because since these systems are quantum systems, they allow to test quantum physics on this kind of discrete hyperbolic geometries. On the other hand, Leggenhager and collaborators have realized, now I'm talking about real object in a lab, the topoelectric circuits which have this discrete geometry. And now the advantage, of course, in this case, that we can really measure quantity in this setup. But on the drawback, if you want, is that since this is just a standard circuit, classical electric circuit, it's not possible to access quantum effects in this kind of setup. So I believe that having experimental realization or attempts for doing so in this kind of setup is a really good motivation. And then finally, let me mention some related works on regular hyperbolic tilings that also make some attempts in order to gain insight about possible discrete holographic dualities. And I want to mention this work by Leyden Boyles and Dickens and Flicker about conformal quasicrystals. And then there are a series of works I report here, some of them by the group by Jans Eiset, where they consider holographic tensor network models on these regular hyperbolic tilings. And then there are the group by Cardinal and the one by Brouwer that are considering various kinds of lattice models on the hyperbolic tiling, and with their analysis trying to gain intuition about what changes in the ADCFT correspondence if we consider modeling the bulk that are discrete model, basically. So now let's go to our construction. And now this idea that I'm going to tell you was originally can be found in the paper by Boyle and collaborators. And so the idea is basically what I was saying, replying to the question. So we start from a central tile. Okay, here we have two examples. That is this dark gray tile. Then we start to add concentrically layers of tiles in such a way to preserve the symmetry of this hexagon, in this case, or the central tile. Then what we do is that every time we add a layer, we call it an inflation step. We'll be clear later why. And we do it for a finite number of time, very large, but finite. And so what we have is the finite tiling I was mentioning before. And in this case, we have, so it's like putting a cutoff in our discrete hyperbolic space. And what we do basically is, the goal is to characterize the boundary of this discrete finite geometry. And as a boundary, we simply mean the set of outermost edges and vertices that we have on this structure. Now, in order to do this characterization, I have already introduced in this picture some colors for the different vertices. Let me explain you the code. So, we start from the red vertices denoted by A as those vertices that have two neighbors within the same layer. What does it mean? So let's consider this red vertex. So every vertex of this 6,4 tiling, by definition, has coordination number equal to 4, because the Q parameter here is 4, so this means that every vertex has coordination number Q. But this specific red one has two neighbors within the same layer, so within the zero layer in this case, and the other two belong to the following layer. On the other hand, there is a second kind of vertices that we denote with the blue color or with letter B, and these are of the following kind. Out of the four neighbors that they have, three of them belong to the same layer, and one of them to the following one. So here we have basically a binary classification of our vertices. And so now we can ask the following question. If we start from the central tile that by construction has only A letters on its vertices.
So it's like red 3 should be the same. Like the
definition. Sorry?
Red 3 neighbors are in the same layer.
You mean with respect to the picture?
Yeah.
No, because this one has, so this red has this and this in the same layer, and these other two are in the following layer.
I was thinking about the faces, like there are four faces and three faces are in the same layer. It's about the word, it's a classification of vertex.
No. Okay, it's specific for, it's a bit misleading, I agree, because I've defined a layer of tiles, so a layer of faces. And here I'm referring to vertices.
Yes.
So it's a bit trickier. So thank you for pointing out this. Okay, so we have a sequence of A letters in the central tile. So we ask, which is the sequence of letters that we have a boundary obtained after a very large number of inflation steps? And now the answer is that we can answer to this question by applying an inflation rule that I'm going to define to the series, to the sequence of A that we have in this around the central tile. What is an inflation rule? An inflation rule is a rule that associates to each letter A given word made up of A and B, and to each letter B a different word made up of A and B. Here I can give you two examples of the inflation rule that characterizes the two tilings that I'm considering here. I'm not going to report the general formula for every P and Q, even if possible to write, because it's enough to check that they are different and that they induce different sequences. And so which is the idea? We start from the central sequence and we apply this inflation rule. The same amount of times as the inflation step that we have taken for constructing our tiling. And what we get is that at the boundary, we have, as a result, a sequence that is called a periodic sequence. So an aperiodic sequence is a sequence that does not have any periodic properties, but still is not a random sequence because it is deterministically generated by this inflation rule. And moreover, since we are assuming to take a very large number of inflation steps, what we have is that one can check that for a very large number of iterations of this inflation rule, the size of the sequence grows with a scaling factor that we call it lambda p and q. It can be estimated, it can be computed for any possible inflation rule, and in this case, depends explicitly on the parameterization of the discretization parameter that we have in the bulk, namely p and q. Here, I just wanted to give you an example. So suppose we start by a single letter A, and we apply three times this inflation rule here. And this is the sequence that we obtain. So it's a sequence whose size grows exponentially, and does not have it's not possible to recognize a given pattern here, and this is what characterizes a periodicity. But still, it is a deterministic rule. So we are not talking about random sequences. That's a very important point. Okay, now the last thing I want to tell you about our discrete bulk, because now we are going to consider this tessellation as a possible bulk, discrete bulk. Is what happens if we take the Yutaka-Nagy formula and we discretize it naively. So the idea is always, the same. We start from a continuous setup with an holographic CFT at the boundary, and then we impose our tessellation, PNQ, and then we want to compute the entanglement entropy of a region at the boundary that now, being it discrete, will be made by a number of L vertices that are the vertices of the tiling I showed you before. The assumption that we do, and at this level is clearly an assumption, is that the Yutaka-Nagy formula still holds, but instead of measuring the length of a continuous geodesics in the Poincaré disk, we measure the length of a discrete geodesics that we are going to define soon. So let's consider, in order to construct the discrete geodesic, let's consider a continuous one that is represented here in blue, and we call little gamma. And okay, here I'm just representing these geodesics on a strip. We know that these are either the diameters of the Poincaré disk or the axis circumferences with endpoints on the boundary. But let me just draw for simplicity on a strip. And then what we do, so far we have considered a tiling, but we haven't chosen an orientation yet. So we are free to orient the tiling as we want. And we choose the orientation in such a way that the tiles that go across the continuous geodesics that we've chosen are cut in exactly two identical parts. And so this is the result that one obtains. This is specific for P and Q both even, but it's possible to generalize this to every parity on P and Q. And therefore, we define as a discrete geodesics the lower part of this of the edges of the tiles that goes along the continuous geodesics, and we represent it here with this red piecewise line, and we denote it with big gamma. At this point, within our assumption, the entanglement entropy will be given by the length of this discrete geodesics over 4G. And now, how to estimate this? Well, now we count the number of polygons that we have along our continuous geodesics, and we denote it with the letter N. Then we multiply by the number of half of the number of edges that we have in each polygon, and here we denote it by nu. And then we have to multiply by the length of each edge that we have defined before as S. Then, so this is the result, and we have performed some manipulation. Basically, I amount to perform a conformal transformation, and it's been possible to relate the number n of patterns that repeat along the continuous geodesics to the length of the subsystem size, so the number of vertices we have in the subsystem size, and this is the result that we obtain. Now, let me comment this formula. So, first of all, the entanglement entropy is found to grow logarithmically in the subsystem size. This is a reasonable expectation because this is the usual behavior we find for conformal field, for one plus one dimensional conformal field theories, or even for critical lattice models, because now we have to think that we are in the discrete, but still this is a behavior that in the thermodynamic limit one finds also for critical lattice models. But now the prefactor is not anymore the Brownian central charge, but is this result multiplied by a non-trivial function of P and Q. And we have called it effective central charge, but clearly this has nothing to do with the central charge of a CFT. This is just the coefficient of the entanglement entropy and somehow a parameter that describes how our entanglement properties are affected by the discretization that we do in the bulk. And so, yes, this is, this is the result. And so we want to stress that there is a logarithmic growth in subsystem size with a coefficient that depends explicitly on the parameters of the discretization. And a similar result has been found in this paper by Isert and collaborators with a different, slightly different prefactor that differs by a constant factor, but we have slightly different assumptions. So within our understanding is that within our assumptions that are different is expected to find this different, this slightly different result. And here, just for completing the discussion, if you want, what happens if you don't have P and Q both even? So basically, the idea is the same, but now the pattern that we have to recognize along the continuous geodesics in order to define the discrete geodesics are different and depends in a non-trivial way, but still under control, on the parameters P and Q. But in the end, the formula, if you want, the function of P and Q that we have is as always this shape, basically. So it does not change in essence, but only the explicit expression, explicit function of P and Q changes. So basically, what you find is that increasing P and Q, this this central charge grows. Okay, grows for large P and Q, and for large Q it grows logarithmically, and for large P grows linearly. So they don't go to a constant value, actually. Yes, but they grow. Yeah, moreover, let me stress, since this parameter does not, it strongly depends on the parity on P and Q, this function, as a function of P and Q, has some oscillations according to the parity, or either on P or Q, but still we can take under control the two envelopes of this oscillating function, and the behavior is what I told you. So it's either logarithmically large for large Q, or linearly large for large P. Okay, so this is what basically the properties I wanted to point out about the bulk that will be useful later in this talk. And before starting to talk explicitly about how to construct a possible boundary theory, let me just do a quick recap. So usually in ADS-CFT, for instance, if you have ADS-3, the quantum gravity theory in ADS-3 is dual to 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT at the boundary in such a way that the ADS-3 vacuum solution are dual, according to a holographic dictionary, to the vacuum state of the CFT. Now, what we do is that we impose this discretization. Now, the expectation is that we find, again, a duality, but now between a theory on the discrete geometry of the PQ tiling, so on the discrete bulk, and a quantum chain at the boundary of this tiling. I mention here quantum chain because, as I told you, if we consider a finite tiling, the boundary is a discrete, basically, it's a discrete set of edges and vertices, so it's very, very reasonable to expect this theory to be a chain. And also we expect, somehow, following the usual holographic dictionary, that the tiling of the Poincaré disk without fluctuating degrees of freedom, without, if you want, matter degrees of freedom, should be dual to the ground state of the quantum chain that we define as a boundary. And so the goal of this talk, and this has been the goal of the work that I'm presenting, is to understand how to construct this quantum chain and which are the properties of the ground state of the quantum chain that are consistent with this step in the holographic dictionary. And of course, it's clearly a future work to be done in order to complete this program to tell something about which should be this the discrete bulk theory that match holographically this quantum chain. And we'll spend some words at the very end, but this is still a work in progress, so we're not able to do predictions at the moment for this. But so let's focus on the boundary theory. So as I told you, at the boundary of the discrete tiling, we have an aperiodic sequence. So let's call it, basically, it's an aperiodic structure that is represented by this aperiodic sequence of letters. Now, let me do the following identification. Here you see a portion of the boundary of the tiling represented schematically. So we identify to each edge a spin 1/2 degrees of freedom, to each vertex a bond connecting to neighboring spins. And then since we have two possible letters to each of the vertex, we associate to each of the bond that connects to neighboring spins two possible couplings, JA and JB. So the resulting system that we have is a spin chain with couplings that are not homogeneous, but follow an aperiodic sequence. So these systems are called aperiodic spin chains and have been studied in condensed matter literature starting from this series of papers. And so what we assume is to have a boundary theory that is basically an aperiodic spin chain whose aperiodic modulation, which is another name for saying the aperiodic sequence of couplings, is given by the inflation rule that is induced by the discretization of the bulk towards the boundary. And so this is the boundary theory that we are going to define. And so let's now start to be more precise about it. So usually when people consider aperiodic spin chains, they start from an homogeneous chain, and then they impose the aperiodicity on the chain, on the homogeneous chain. So from our point of view, we start from a critical homogeneous chain. And the reason is that in ADS-CFT, the boundary theory is a conformal field theory, which is a low energy description of a critical lattice system. And therefore, we assume to have a critical homogeneous chain, and then we impose the discretization, the aperiodic modulation induced by the bulk discretization, as explained a few slides ago. Now we have three possibilities. So the first possibility is that the system, the lattice system that we have initially, that is an homogeneous fixed point in the sense of the RG, is such that this fixed point is driven, the system is driven into a new fixed point that is induced by the aperiodicity, and usually we call this point strong disordered fixed point. The second option is that the aperiodicity induced on the homogeneous chain introduce a line a continuous line of fixed point that interpolates between the homogeneous fixed point and the strong disorder one. And in this case, the aperiodic modulation is called marginal. Or the third case is whether the presence of a aperiodicity does not affect in any way the critical properties of the system. And if this happens, we say that the modulation is irrelevant. Now, we choose a very specific model, a periodic spin chain, and we try to see what happens, what happens if we assume to have at the boundary of our discrete geometry this model that is an aperiodic XXZ chain. Now, this is the Hamiltonian that we're going to consider. Now, we assume that the periodicity is encoded in the hopping parameters of the spin chain, that are Ji, that then, according to the position in the sequence where they are, can take value Ja or Jb. Then, we can always rescale this Hamiltonian, of course, and so the physical relevant parameters is the ratio between JA and JB that we call little r. Then the other important physical parameter is delta naught that is called anisotropy, and this usually tune the interaction of the aperiodic spin chain. of the aperiodic X, X, Z chain. And indeed, we choose the delta knot to be between 0 and 1. And doing so, we have, first of all, an interacting model. And we also have the system, even in presence of aperiodicity, is a gapless system. So the spin chain is gapless. And so we are falling somehow in this hypothesis that we've done. And what we want to do is to study the properties of this spin chain. So let me stress that we have a different aperiodic X, X, Z spin chain at the boundary of every different tessellation of the bulk. So somehow for every P and Q in the bulk, we have a different aperiodic spin chain in the sense that the sequence of coupling changes from pair to pair of P and Q parameters.
Just one thought.
Yeah.
The definition of periodic chain is when the edge, all the edges are same color, like all red or all blue. That's a periodic chain you might mention. Periodic,
yes. Yeah. Okay, so thank you for your question. So in general, if you set all the bonds either red or blue, you get an homogeneous chain. Then it can be periodic if you put it on a ring, for instance, or can be an infinite system on if you put it on a line. The point is that while what you are talking about as translational, as discrete translational invariance, either if it is on a circle or on an infinite line, this in this model, the translational invariant is clearly broken. And this is the crucial difference between if you want an aperiodic spin chain and an homogeneous one, that yes, can be periodic, but can also be simply infinite, but still characterized by translational invariance.
Yeah, I see. And the other question is like, then what is it like the whole probability for this whole periodic chain?
Yeah, no, okay. So from the point, so, okay, let's comment about the properties of this model without a periodicity. This is a well-understood model in statistical physics and condensed matter theory. And it is a critical system, and therefore in the continuum limit is described by conformal field theory, which is a compact boson, okay, where the value of the interaction parameter delta is encoded in the compactification radius. So from the conformal field theory point of view, the continuous limit of this...
It's just a compact boson.
Yes, it's just a compact boson. And therefore, this is not a large central charge conformal field theory, because the central charge is equal to 1. So clearly, it's really a toy model at this level, because we don't have in this chain any notion of large n at the moment. So while we know that in holography, okay, we should have a parameter that can be tuned in order to get in the large n, defines the large n limit in ADS-CFT. Here we don't have nothing like that for the moment. So it's really, indeed, I actually said, let's try to put this model at the boundary, let's see what happens, and then we will see which are the consequences and which are the things that maybe should be tuned in order to have a better defined holographic model, let's say. But yes, from the point of view, I mean, the CFT underlying this model is a compact boson, free theory. So there's nothing, it's nothing holographic.
You can tune P and Q.
Sorry?
You can tune P and Q.
So the P and Q parameter?
Yes,
yes, actually we can tune them. And so this is actually another thing that we ask. So given these, given the properties of this theory, how would they change if we change the P and Q parameters? So the change that we do on the system if we change P and Q, it's not a smooth change, because you have to imagine, let's fix P and Q, and these chains will have an aperiodic sequence of couplings. If you increase, for instance, P by 1 unit, the aperiodic sequence changes completely. It's still aperiodic, but it's a complete different sequence. So it's very, I mean, drawing some expectations on the P and Q parameter, it's very highly non-trivial, because in general, there's no reason to expect that by tuning P of 1 unit, we have a small change. And if we tune P, for instance, we change by a large amount, we should have a very large change. There's no reason, because if you want, the modification that we do in our Hamiltonian are not continuous. Now, so given two different pairs of P and Q, the aperiodic sequence can change even very, very much consistently. So yes, but in principle, we can tune. And this is actually what we study in the following. Okay, so we have an aperiodic critical model now. Let's study the critical properties of this model. And the techniques that we use is called strong disorder normalization group. It is a technique that's been introduced by Dasgupta and Ma in the context of random systems, and has been adapted by Vieira and Hida some 25 years later to a periodic spin chains. And so this is a rather technical approach, but let me give just slash the physical features. So the idea is to perform a real space normalization group to decimate the block of consecutive spins that are coupled by strong couplings. What do I mean? So assume that one of the two, JA or JB, is much bigger than the other one. So if this happens, we can think that in the low energy, at low energy, the block of spins that are connected by this strong bond, or these strong couplings, can be decimated out from the system in the sense that they decouple thermodynamically from the system. And so what happens is that, supposed to take, for instance, the most simplest example, two spin blocks that are coupled by a strong coupling, we decimate it out, and then what we have is that effectively we have a new coupling, a new bond that with couplings that should be that are different from before. And for instance, the new coupling can be estimated, for instance, by perturbation theory, given that we are assuming that one of the two couplings is much greater than the other. So we can consider the Hamiltonian of these two spins as a given Hamiltonian and the rest as a perturbation, if you want. And then by doing this this perturbation theory, we can obtain how the couplings changes. And here, for instance, we have these two functions that are two functions that can be computed case by case for different n. There is no closed expression for n in general. And therefore, if we every time we do a decimation, we get a new values of the coupling, what we are doing is effectively a renormalization group flow of the couplings. And this is what, in general, is called strong disorder renormalization group, because the degrees of freedom to decimate are encoded into the non-homogeneity of our chain. And this is the reason why this RG is called strong disorder. These are other examples. For instance, if we decimate a block of, for instance, an odd number of spins, we don't have only a new coupling line in this case, but we have an effective spin sigma naught that is coupled to the rest of the chain by two new effective couplings, whose expression, again, can be computed in the context of perturbation theory. So what we have done is to apply to machinery to all the possible XXZ aperiodic Hamiltonians with all the possible modulation induced by the PQ tilings of the bulk tiling. And what we found is the following result, that if we consider delta naught different from one, but still between zero and one, all the periodic modulation, so the periodic modulation generated by all the P and Q inflation rules are marginal. So there is this line of fixed point arising that interpolates between the strong disorder case and the homogeneous case. The peculiar behavior occurs when delta naught is equal to one, and the chain, the Hamiltonian I showed you before is the Hamiltonian for the aperiodic XXX chain. In this case, the disorder, the periodic modulation is relevant in the sense that the system is driven to a new strong disorder fixed point. And what we want to do in the following is to characterize in some way the new fixed point that arises in this aperiodic XXX chain that we can have as a boundary theory of that we are trying to put as a boundary theory of the discrete holographic setup. And in order to do so, we compute the entanglement entropy of these chains. So what we have basically done is to generalize the results by Zimboras, Yuas, and Gloy to a more general class of aperiodic modulations. So this approach for entanglement entropy is based on the SDRG, so on this approach. And we have somehow generalized the results contained here to a more general class. Let me stress that unfortunately, with this class, we have to impose some restriction and not all the P and Q inflation rule can be treated. But still, we are happy because we have an infinite class of periodic modulation that can be treated. And then we have done this analysis computing the entanglement entropy for a block of consecutive spins, we call it A, and the result is represented in this plot, for instance, in the case where P equal to 6 and Q is equal to 5. So let's discuss the feature of this plot. So first of all, the proper entanglement entropy, the analytic expression, is given by this black piecewise linear curve. And what we have here is that this visual linear behavior is peculiar of the aperiodic chains, as has been already found in this paper for a reduced class of aperiodicity. But then the new feature arrives here for us because we have these two logarithmic envelopes that are represented here in green and in red. And these two envelopes, the reason because we have two envelopes rather than one is a bit technical. It relies on the assumption, on the restriction that we have performed on this aperiodic sequence. And later we can discuss it better, but the point of these envelopes is not really that they are two, but it's really that they have the same coefficient of the logarithmic growth. So these are the schematic expression for these two envelopes. They have the additive constant is different, but the logarithmic growth is the same. And this coefficient that we call, again, effective central charge, depends on P and Q. In general, for different P and Q, we get a different coefficient. So let me say that in this case, for all the cases that we have analyzed, we have found that the entanglement entropy has an overall logarithmic growth with a coefficient, with a prefactor, that again depends on P and Q. Now, this should remind you what we have said a few slides ago about the behavior of the holographic entanglement entropy if you consider the discretization of the Ryuta-Kanagi formula. It was qualitatively exactly the same, namely logarithmic growth times coefficient dependent on P and Q. Now, point is that this coefficient is qualitatively similar because it's dependent on P and Q, but quantitatively, the two functions are not the same. We plotted, we have done some, we have tried to see whether they match in some regime, and they actually don't match. And so, therefore, what does it mean? This means that the model that that we have considered, and was argued by in some questions beforehand, is probably not a model that could be a boundary theory for a discrete holographic setup. And probably we should improve this model. For instance, a possibility would be by adding a notion of large N limit or something that can mimic what is the large N limit for a continuous ID SFT, given that the Ryuta-Kanagi formula that we have discretized is a result that holds in the large N limit. And so this is clearly a consideration, something that you are trying to fix for future works, and we'll discuss some possible improvement in the final slide. But still, let me stress that there is some hope, because, however, the qualitative behavior is very similar. And so the last thing I want to tell you before...
I have a kappa 1 and kappa 2, how are they again?
So no, these two parameters, we have just fitted these two parameters. We haven't been able to determine them.
To the defect entropy or something like that?
Sorry?
Is it related to the defect entropy or something like that?
This is the question. So,
reminds me of some boundary entropy.
Yes. Yeah, but in this case, we don't have any notion of boundary. This is the problem. I would have to think more about it, but I don't think so, because those, as you know, those terms appear when you have, for instance, the entanglement entropy in a BCFT. Oh, and there is the constant term related to the boundary states on the BCFT and so on and so forth. Here we don't have anything similar. This is just if you want a computation for a spin chain that in our idealization is an infinite spin chain. We take a block of consecutive spins. So I don't think that is related to boundary entropy.
Okay, thank
you. Okay, so the last thing before concluding, I want to mention an additional result that we have obtained and trying to addressing the following question. Now that we have understood somehow the ground state of the spin chain that we have at the boundary, can this be reflected somehow in the bulk? And an help in answering this question can come from the tensor network. And so we have tried to combine the tensor network's idea and the SDRG, and we have done in the following way. So we have followed the idea by containing this paper by Hayden and collaborators. And what we've done is the following. So these are the two schematic decimation steps I showed you before. But now we have added on top of it some tensors, okay, that are the component of the tensor network that we are going to construct. So every time that we decimate, for instance, a block of two consecutive spins, of two consecutive strongly coupled spins, we add to the tensor network a rank two tensor represented by this state T2 defined in this way. Every time that we have an unrenormalized spin, we simply add this tensor T1 with this identity. And here, for instance, a more complicated tensor if we decimate out a block of an odd number of spins. But in general, we can schematically define the tensors in terms of states that we've added to the tensor network step after step through these relations. And this idea is actually contained in this paper. So what we do practically is the following. We start from the original chain. We perform a SDRG step. And we add these components of the tensor network. Then we iterate the decimation step, and we add another layer for the tensor network, properly contracting the legs of the tensor. So what we obtain is finally a tensor network whose boundary state by construction is exactly the ground state of the XXX chain that we have constructed. And the reason is that this tensor network has been constructed exactly through the SDRG that completely characterize, since we have a relevant modulation, our spin chain at the ground state of our spin chain at the boundary. And okay, this tensor network exists per se and independently of any bulk we can have. But of course, it's interesting to overlap this tensor network with the discrete bulk that we are considering. And we found this very nice picture. So here, the green lines are the legs of the tensor network. And every time we have an intersection between two green lines, actually, we have to think that there is a tensor, one of these tensor, or the tensor associated with this tensor, to these local tensor states. Let me first comment the following. So if we once study the symmetry of this tensor network graph, the only symmetry we can find is that the symmetry given by the dihedral group, namely the symmetry under discrete ZP rotation and the reflection. And this, as I commented at the beginning, is exactly the symmetry that we have for our finite regular hyperbolic tiling. And so somehow the tensor network graph is consistent with the symmetry that we are having in the bulk. But now, okay, this is a nice construction, a nice matching of the symmetry, but what can we gain with this? And we have tried to gain more insight about the entanglement of the boundary theory from this bulk tensor network. Because as I told you, the SDRG result that I showed you in the previous slide holds for a restricted class of P and Q discretization of the bulk, and therefore for a restricted class of a periodic XXZ chain. Now, we actually manage to obtain the effective central charge for a wider class of PQ aperiodic XXZ chain by exploiting this tensor network construction in the bulk. But the price to pay is that since we are working with tensor networks, we can just write down an upper bound for the effective central charge, but still it can be given as a function of P and Q. And here we reported the example for even number and generic Q. So somehow this result generalizes what we found with a different approach, but in a, let's say, lighter way. So I have to stress that this bound is saturated in some cases. And this, from the tensor network point of view, happens when the tensor involves are perfect tensors. Now, in this work, we have proved that the tensor that appears in some specific class of P and Q regular tilings are actually perfect tensors. And therefore, this bound is saturated in those cases. Interestingly, the cases where the tensors in the network are perfect are exactly the cases that can be treated analytically with the other approach I showed. And therefore, by deriving these results through the tensor network, it's been possible to also cross-check the results that we have obtained through a completely, not completely, but through a different approach. Because still, both of them rely on the SDRG. But here, basically, for computing this bound, we count the number of tensor legs that are cutted by a minimal surface. In the other case, we actually compute the entanglement entropy with spin chain techniques. So somehow, even if related, the two techniques are not completely the same. And so we have been able also to do this cross-check thanks to this tensor network approach. Now, I want to conclude just basically summarizing the idea of our setup, this containing this square diagram. So we started from a fixed time slice of ADS3, and we have discretized it to regular hyperbolic tilings because the idea is that we want to do some steps towards a discrete holographic duality. And we have noticed that in the tile, the tessellated Poincaré disk is such that the PQ tiling induces at the boundary an aperiodic sequence. And this aperiodic sequence suggests to consider a boundary theory that is an aperiodic spin chain whose aperiodicity exactly matches the aperiodicity induced from the bulk to the boundary. And then as an explicit choice, we have considered an aperiodic XXZ model, and we have studied the critical properties, and in particular, the entanglement properties, finding this very interesting logarithmic growth in the subsystem size with a coefficient that depends on P and Q that I want to stress again, is qualitatively similar to what we found by naively discretized RT formula, but not quantitatively, and therefore, we should definitely improve the boundary chain that we have. And then at the end, in terms of the SCRG, we have constructed a tensor network in the bulk that, interestingly, as a graph, has the same symmetry as the tiling that we are considering. And this is the reason why we have drawn this dashed line. Now, the line is dashed because, of course, as I said at the beginning, we would really need to have some fluctuating degrees of freedom in the bulk. And this would be the first step, basically, in order to close this diagram. And as a future perspective, actually, so as I've stressed various times throughout this talk, we really need to consider other boundary theories in order to see whether the results that we've obtained improve in the sense of approaching to our bulk discretization of the Ryutaki-Yanagi formula. And a nice hint comes from the symmetry in IDSCFT, because as you know, for instance, in standard IDSCFT, the operators on the boundary CFT transform accordingly to a reducible representation of the conformal group, which is the isometric group of the bulk spacetime. So here we can think to do something similar. And so if we start from the finite tilings, as we have done throughout the talk, the symmetry, as I said, is the dihedral symmetry, whose reducible representations are known. And so one can, in principle, construct a boundary theory with local degrees of freedom that transform according to the reducible representation of this dihedral group and see what does it change in the properties of the theory. Or this is another very interesting step is instead of staying in a finite tiling as a bulk, extending what happens if we consider as the whole tessellation of the Poincaré disk. And this, in terms of the representation theory, would require to know the irreducible representation, for instance, of this triangle group. Now, in this work that I mentioned by Buecher and Tomar and collaborators, they consider some degrees of freedom in the holographic in the hyperbolic tessellation that transform accordingly the one-dimensional irreducible representation of this group. But this group, as I said before, is a non-abelian group. Therefore, does not only have one-dimensional irreducible representation, but also higher-dimensional one. Now, what we're trying to do is try to understand this problem from the mathematical point of view, because these representations are not classified in the sense that physicists, at least, we are used to see. And so we are trying to understand how much the mathematical literature has digged into this problem, because this would allow to properly define a theory which is covariant under this triangle group. And finally, as I mentioned at the very end, we would like to mention some possible direction to explore in order to define a bulk theory and some fluctuating degrees of freedom in the discrete bulk. There is this very interesting approach by Gubser, Heidemann, Marcolli, and collaborators called edge-length dynamics. What they basically do is to introduce a statistical mechanics model on the discrete bulk, where the degrees of freedom that fluctuates are the length of the edges. And they have written down a variational principle, so a free energy to minimize. And this free energy has been constructed in a very nice way by discretizing the Einstein-Hilbert action. And they found, they solved the variational principle, they found that the highest configuration, the highest probability configuration of the bulk is actually the one where all the edges are of the same size. But this is exactly the configuration that we have considered in this talk as a, if you want, the empty tiling, which is we're supposed to be dual to the ground state of the spin chain. So this really makes this approach very interesting for us. And what we have to do is to understand it better and possibly to adapt and to put in the context of this holographic setup that we have discussed so far. And finally, it's a very intriguing idea to consider causal dynamical triangulation to add dynamics to our discrete bulk. Now, this would require to introduce a discretized time direction. And this, therefore, means that we are considering what we should consider regular tessellation of a 3D hyperbolic spacetime. For instance, with regular polyhedra, this could be a possibility. And this, so it's not only very interesting from the physical point of view, because it would be a proposal for a discrete model of gravity, but also from the mathematical point of view, because in some cases, this 3D regular tessellation of anti de Sitter space times have been studied, and fractal structure have been shown to be emerging at the boundary. And so this really also related to a lot of mathematical literature, very interesting in the fractal. In the theories of fractals. So this is all from my side. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, any questions for our speakers? Thank you for anybody.
I have a question. Are the absolute chains somehow linked to irrational units of torques? Because in this case, we have just two values of length for those intervals. But if you have some another time, not what you mentioned, it can be like
minimal sample. That's actually a good question. So, not sure to be able to reply, actually. What I can tell you is that in the context of the regular hyperbolic tilings, higher genus geometries arises. For instance, if we consider the infinite hyperbolic tiling, one can be tempted to usually in condensed matter physics, what we do is we take a unit cell, we identify the opposite part, and we impose translational invariance in this way. So one can be tempted to do it in this case by identifying, for instance, the opposite edges of this tiling. What for some tilings that have been classified in the literature, what you get is a higher genus Riemann surface whose genus depends on the specific choice of P and Q. So, and therefore, one can choose P and Q in some way to get, for instance, a torus out of this compactification. Now, what I don't know, actually, it would be very interesting to understand, is whether this can be seen also from the boundary point of view for us, from the spin chain itself. From this point of view, I really don't, I'm not sure how to reply. So you mean from here by introducing more, this was your question, right? Yeah, this actually I don't know. But I know that, for instance, from the bulk point of view, there have been this higher genus geometry emerging. So maybe there could be some hope to relate it to what you were explaining. Maybe, yeah, we'd be glad to discuss it.
Okay, thank you. So in the last slide, you mentioned reference about this Luther and this is about p-adic string theory.
Yes, that is a p-adic ADSFT. What they do is that they start from these statistical mechanic systems, for the bulk, and then they consider these fluctuating edges, and then they determine the highest probability configuration to be exactly similar one that we have. They work on these p-adic trees that are a different structure with respect to what we have, because let me show you the picture just for having something concrete. So clearly this graph is not a tree, not because it has loops. Somehow, from the graph point of view only, the p-adic ADSF, so the p-adic, the Bruhat-Zitz tree, that is the bulk that p-adic ADSFT consider, can be recovered if we push our p parameter to infinite. So we take this tiling with p infinite, and then we have now an infinite comma q tiling, which is analogous to the q plus one tree that they have considered in the p-adic ADSFT story. So at the level of the graph, there is a connection. Now the point is that when they go in the Bruhat-Zitz tree as a bulk, they impose this additional p-adic number structure on the bulk that induces the p-adic number structure on the boundary. Now we don't have anything like that. But the result that they prove for this bulk model for fluctuating edges, of course in the case of trees, that they're the one they are interested in. But they also claim that holds every time that we have a PQ tiling like this, when P is sufficiently large. What does it mean? They actually say that if P is greater or equal than 7, their argument for this bulk fluctuating model, this edges fluctuating model, still holds. And so therefore, this is also, it would be very interesting to see whether we can consider this setup for P very large and somehow match, when I was talking about the edge length dynamics, to match in our setup, this would require to take these tilings, not necessarily with p infinite, but with p larger than 7. It is a reasonable assumption. If we have a bound, we don't have to take infinite, because when a parameter is infinite, it's not, if you start from a finite one and go to infinite, it's always difficult to work. But if you have a bound, a threshold after which you can be safe from this point of view, they actually hope to try to adapt what they are doing to what to our setup.
A question. Have you tried to take a single tree, for example, and if you view this sequence as a sequence of zero, for example, take A zero B one, and try to view it as a number of binary numbers. It would be some specific numbers.
This is a very nice question. Actually, I don't know, but I cannot exclude this because clearly there are papers in this context that use the notation instead of A and B, 0 and 1.
Yes.
So, yeah, I don't know if they have in mind something similar, but actually, I'm not able to reply, but probably yes, it would be interesting to see which kind of binary number these are associated to. Yes, actually. Thank you for the question.
Any further questions? If not, let's make this speaker.